Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Rose. It's a certified case. The government is the appellant. Counsel for the government, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Major Coretta Gray, and I, along with Mr. Gerald R. Bruce, represent the United States in this matter. The case before you today really boils down to actions speak louder than words. The actions on the part of the appellee at the trial level, which support that his controlling concern was limiting confinement through a PTA, speak louder than his words on appeal that but for his question about sex offender registration going unanswered, he would not have accepted the pretrial agreement.
And so you're moving right to prejudice?
Well, I'm going to take up both issues in terms of the affirmative misrepresentation issue and prejudice, but I want to get that out there. There absolutely is no prejudice in this case.
Well, do you agree with the CCA that there was an affirmative misrepresentation?
We do not, Your Honor.
How about ineffective assistance of counsel?
We do not agree with the CCA on that, Your Honor.
Counsel, you stated in your opening remarks that the primary concern was the length of incarceration. And yet in the conclusions of the debate judge, that isn't found. There certainly was testimony about that, but in the conclusions, the military judge, the debate judge, found that a key concern was the sexual registration.
Well, that's the distinction, Your Honor, is that the military judge found that was a key concern.
But
she did not find that that was the controlling concern.
But she didn't find that length of incarceration was a controlling concern.
True. She did not. Although her issue at the debate was what, if anything, did he know about sex offender registration at the time of his guilty plea? So in terms of whether sex offender registration in particular was an issue for him, it was clear from the testimony that it was an issue, even a key issue. But we have Mr. Connor's testimony as well as the appellee's testimony that support that it was not the controlling issue. And certainly appellee's actions after we found out that he did have to register for sure, according to him, support that confinement was his controlling concern.
Did counsel investigate the answer to appellant's question?
Did Mr. Connors, the civilian counsel, did he investigate it? It does not appear that he did. He
kept saying competent representation if a client asks you a question and repeatedly asks you the question and you don't investigate it, is there a reasonable strategic or tactical reason for not investigating the answer to that question?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, I believe that it is clear or that it's the United States' position that not answering a question regarding a collateral consequence does not per se equal ineffective assistance of counsel. And that's what I would assert.
So it was effective representation in this case.
It was not perfect representation. But that's not required.
So you would encourage at the JAG school that people are taught that when their clients ask them questions, don't answer or answer incompletely?
Well, you know, Your Honor, that is actually what's going to be the key practical takeaway from this case, we believe. Because what we're left with, if this court rules against the government or affirms the CCA, what we're going to be left with is defense counsel in the field trying to figure out what, if anything, do I tell my client about collateral consequences? Yes, we have Miller saying that you should tell your client about the federal.
This wasn't collateral consequences for all matters. This was a very specific question which the judge found that the counsel had been asked a number of times, not once, but a number of times. There seems to be no factual dispute on that. Is there a strategic or tactical reason why counsel should not have investigated and answered the question? Putting aside prong two, which is the prejudice prong, but what is the strategic or tactical reason that counsel did not find out the answer to that question?
Well, in this case, Mr. Connors said in the debate hearing that the reason he did not get a full and complete answer to the question was because he was basically overcome by other more pressing concerns, which was negotiating the PTA, which the appellee wanted. Now, could there be a reason not to investigate it because maybe you're concerned that you'll get the information wrong? Because there are at least three different states that this appellee was interested in, and it can be sticky and sort of technical, depending on which state you're in, on whether these specific specifications with equal requirements to register as a sex offender. Now, as for the federal rules, probably that would not have been so confusing, but this appellee was looking for these specific three different states. So while we're not saying that we would support or teach or want defense counsel to go out there and have an appellee asking them a question three times and not answering it, what we're saying is imperfect representation is not that you did not get a fair trial or you did not get representation as required under the Sixth Amendment. Counsel the people have gone to trial and have had cases where all of their questions, especially about collateral consequences, and Your Honor, I guess I would take issue with your earlier statement that it was no dispute that this collateral consequence or that this wasn't a collateral consequence. Sex offender registration, we believe
it
is.
I didn't say it wasn't. It clearly is.
Okay. I may have misunderstood you earlier, Your Honor.
Leaving aside the question of whether or not there was an affirmative representation, is affirmative misrepresentation of a collateral consequence IAC per se?
No, it is not, Your Honor. And that is an extremely important issue. No, it is one thing to look at based on what this court has said in United States versus Miller, but it is not per se ineffective. And here, this appellee absolutely got the benefit of his counsel and a fair trial. He wanted to limit confinement. He got a PTA for 24 months. His counsel actually got him 20 months.
Did the judge ask him in the care inquiry whether he was satisfied with his counsel?
He did, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, he did.
What did he say?
He said that he was satisfied with his counsel, and actually the judge went on sua sponte to ask appellee, all right, Airman Rose, I don't believe anything this morning or this afternoon has taken you by surprise. Nevertheless, if you would like, we've had extended delays and recesses. I'll be happy to give you any more time you need to discuss any outstanding issues or questions you have with your lawyers, or we can press on. That's your call.
Counsel, did the attorney tell his client, this is a complex issue, and I need more time to research it?
The attorney told his client, I don't know the answer, I'm not sure about the answer, and I need to look into it further.
What else did he tell him?
He also told him each time, he said those three things. He also said, but I don't think that you should have to register based on my reading of these seem like minor offenses and the girls are friends with you now. And so he caveated. It was equivocal every single time. But I think what's important.
So the government's view that when the judge said to the accused at trial, is there anything else you'd like to discuss? He should have said, I can't get an answer out of my lawyer. I want more time for him to research this collateral consequences issue.
Yes, Your Honor. That was the open door opportunity. Anything, any outstanding issues or questions you have with your lawyers, or we can press on. And the accused said, we can press on, sir. So this goes clear. And then he said, the judge said, very well, do you still want to plead guilty? Yes, sir. And this is after having gone through the whole colloquy about the pretrial agreement, his counsel's representation of him, the advice from his counsel. This appellee, if he was confused or if he knew that his question went unanswered, which it is clear that he felt like.
So he couldn't rely on his attorney's statement regarding the lack of likelihood that this would be a collateral consequence.
It would be unreasonable for him to have relied on that, knowing that each time his attorney also said, I don't know the answer to this question. I am not sure about the answer to this question. I need to research the answer to this question further. Given that, even coupled with, but in my opinion, I think these are so low level, you probably shouldn't have to, this appellee, it was unreasonable for him to go into court and rely on these impressions, as the debate military, judge found, and then come back and say on appeal after everything is over, oh, wait, my main only controlling concern was whether I would have to register as a sex offender. And so even when I had opportunity after opportunity to clear that up, because that was the most important issue for me, I didn't do it.
Does the record reflect when precisely the accused was informed that he, in fact, did need to register as a sex offender?
The appellee says he found out when he went into confinement. confinement.
So the first day he went into confinement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was that before or after he would have submitted his clemency materials?
That was before, Your Honor.
Did he take issue with the sex offender registration at any point during the clemency process?
He did not. As a matter of fact, when it came to any discussion about how this key, and the most important issue to me was I was fooled about, when it came to that and his response to that, what the convening authority and the record shows what he did was be silent. He said nothing about it. So that speaks volumes as to whether this was really his controlling concern. But now what we do know he did was ask for more time off of his confinement.
Well, the question whether it was his controlling concern or not goes to whether the CCA was correct to find that it was prejudicial, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
To the but-for, whether it was a but-for clause of him, but it doesn't go to whether there was an affirmative misrepresentation or not.
Well, you're right. It does not go to the affirmative misrepresentation. For that, you have to just look at Mr. Connor's statements of, I don't know, and the military judge's finding that the question went unanswered, as opposed to the question was answered, you do not have to register.
Well, the fact that he didn't raise it at all in the clemency suggests that, in fact, he wasn't surprised to find out that he had to register.
And that's exactly right, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, that would be supported by the appellee talking about hearing rumors previous to engaging with Mr. Connors and his new military defense counsel, and based on his knowledge of these rumors that he might have to register, that's why he asked the question two or three times in the course of the representation. So, and then that kind of brings us, you know, to the question, well, where did those rumors come from? It may have come from his initial defense counsel.
What happened to the first counsel?
He separated after the Article 32 hearing, and so then appellee received a new military defense counsel. But having this knowledge that there are at least rumors that you might have to register, again, goes to the idea that it is actually unreasonable for him to have gone into court and to say, I had no idea that I might have to register. Had I known that I might have to register, I would have never entered into this pretrial agreement and pled guilty. He at least knew there was a possibility, which was why he was saying, I heard rumors about it. So this appellee is really, I mean, his actions are speaking volumes. And the fact that the one thing he did was call his mother. Even the military Dubay judge asked, so when you find out that you will have to register as a sex offender, you mean to tell me that you don't go back to your original counsel and ask them what happened or what happened with their advice? And the appellee says, no, I did not go back to them. I was too angry, I felt too betrayed to go back and even talk to them about the fact that they frankly lied to me. That just seems, that's unreasonable to believe that that's how that happened. The fact that the appellee maintained the same military defense counsel, the military defense counsel was the same one who was representing him at trial, who supposedly was surprised to find out that he was, pleading guilty. He had an opportunity to bring up with that one, hey, that civilian I hired lied to me. But that's not the case. Actually, the appellee was the one who lied. In his initial declaration, he said, Mr. Connors told me that I would not have to register. Then at the Dubay hearing, the Dubay military judge has him clear that up, and he answers, as a matter of fact, he didn't tell me that I would not have to register. He just didn't answer my question.
Counsel, with respect to the record, the Dubay judge expressly found that Rose was given the impression he would not have to register. This impression was reasonable under the circumstances. And the Court of Criminal Appeals found that that finding was supported by the evidence and not clearly erroneous. Does the government contend that that was clearly erroneous?
We do believe that that was clearly erroneous. We also note that the CCA said at footnote 5 that they recognized that the military judge's conclusions that this impression was reasonable under the circumstances is not a finding of fact, but a conclusion reached by the judge based on the other findings of fact. That's what they dropped at footnote 5. But just with your...
Is that the government's position with respect to how we should review all Dubay hearings in which a judge views a series of statements and then reaches a finding or conclusion as to what those mean? Is this a conclusion of law that he would not have to register? Why isn't it a finding of fact?
Well, I think that to me, Your Honor, this footnote 5 is really not clear. They use the word conclusion, but they don't really say a conclusion of law.
I'm just talking about I understand your argument as to whether it's clearly erroneous or not, but why isn't it a finding of fact?
Well, it's... Why isn't it a finding of fact?
That is the impression that he would not have to register. This impression was reasonable under the circumstances. I understand your argument as to why you believe that's clearly erroneous. I'm only focusing on the question of whether or not it's a finding of fact.
I believe that this is not a finding of fact because the military judge basically discussed all the facts that she found before making this kind of summary conclusory statement. So all her facts were the question went unanswered. He didn't say, yes, you have to. He didn't say, no, you didn't have to. But the appellee asked two or three times. Those were the facts. This final summarized, this is what I conclude based on this fact, makes this really a conclusion as opposed to a fact that it was a reasonable impression.
It's a conclusion of law?
I don't really think it's a conclusion of law, Your
Honor.
If
it's not a conclusion of law and the CCA sent the case back to the Dubay judge to tell the CCA what happened, why isn't this a statement of historical fact as to what happened? It may be clearly erroneous, but why isn't it the judge's statement as to what happened?
Or is it an opinion?
That's what I really think it is, Your Honor. It's the Dubay judge's opinion. Thank you, Judge Ryan. Because it's not really a conclusion of law, and it's definitely not a fact when she lays out all the other facts that she found before coming to this opinion.
So it's outside the judge's authority as a Dubay judge to find, as a matter of fact, whether Rose was or was not given the impression that he would have to register.
Is it outside the authority
right.
of the Dubay judge?
In other words, why didn't the Dubay judge have the authority to conclude, as a factual matter, whether or not Rose was given the impression that he would not have to register?
Counsel, are you suggesting that that's the opinion part, or that it's the part that this impression was reasonable under the circumstances? It's the opinion part.
The latter, Your Honor.
Thank you.
With the latter.
Who represents the government here? I'm getting confused.
Well, I would agree and assert that that's the United States' position. It really is. It is sort of difficult to figure out what it is, but it's definitely not a finding of fact, and it's definitely not a conclusion of law. So it's left to be something else, and I think an opinion really does categorize what it is properly. I want to make one really important point, I think, too, about the practical aspects of what would happen in
this case. Difference does it make whether the impression was reasonable or not with respect to this case? If he was given the impression that he would not have to register, I understand your argument that that's clearly erroneous, but if he was, as a matter of fact, given the impression that he would not have to register, why is that not, at least within the first prong of Strickland, ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, the issue is this, Your Honor. This idea of it now boiling down to impressions that an appellee receives from their counsel is rife with problems. Your counsel may give you the impression that you're going to be acquitted. They may give you the impression that a witness may get torn up on cross-examination. They may give you the impression that you're not going to get the maximum sentence. All of those are judgment calls, and I would call them educated guesses based on their experience. So when you're saying, I will find affirmative misrepresentation that I told you the wrong answer, not because you told me the wrong answer, which the military judge found that he didn't do, but because you left me with an impression of this answer that I didn't really want to hear, though I know there are rumors out there, I know you didn't tell me that I did not have to register.
Where does it say he didn't want to hear this?
Well,
the record?
I would say that that's a reasonable interpretation of...
A reasonable impression from the record.
A reasonable impression from counsel, Your Honor.
Maybe your opinion of what the record stands
well,
for.
Well, I would say it is my opinion, yes. But the important thing about this impression thing is that this is really going to leave the door open for what Judge Thompson was talking about, which is on these collateral issues, all of these appellees come in now saying, my counsel failed to answer the question, or my counsel's eyebrow went up and made me think, oh, I might win that, or my counsel seemed very confident and made me think that I might win that, or all of these things that counsel do because they're trying to give their client some sort of direction about how this thing may go, but this is out of their control, so all they can give is an educated guess. Being left with just an impression even a reasonable one, is extremely dangerous. It is ripe for lots of litigation based on things that are really frivolous. In this case, the Dubé hearing judge found the question was not answered. Therefore, it cannot be an affirmative misrepresentation if you never even answer the question. And therefore, it could not be reasonable to base your whole decision about whether to plead guilty and subject to yourself to sex offender registration based on an impression you got from your counsel, especially when you had every opportunity to clear it up. And then we get to the prejudice, and then on the clemency, it's still not even important to you, only confinement is. So this impression thing is very dangerous, and especially because we want counsel to be able to give their clients some advice. Really what happens with this case is that this, if you rule against the government here, or you affirm the CCA, you're holding these counsel to a standard that was higher than Miller before Miller was even decided. Because Miller, of course, says you should tell your counsel about your client about the federal registry, and you should put that on the record. But if you don't, that is not per se ineffective assistance of counsel, leaving open the idea that you may have said nothing and still not be found ineffective.
Counsel, Miller wasn't a case where the client specifically asked the question as to sexual registration, was it?
It was not.
Okay.
So
it's a little different in this case. Before you sit down, I'd be interested to know whether or not you're familiar with the Padilla case that's going to be argued by the Supreme Court, in front of the Supreme Court on October 13th.
I am familiar.
Do you think that that case will have ramifications as to what we may decide in this case, or? You don't have to answer. If you don't know, I mean, the issues are very.
Issues are very, very similar, much like the NATO. They're all very similar in this. Ineffective assistance of counsel with these issues, with these collateral matters. I would like to withhold an answer on that question.
Thank you.
Just to quickly just finish that. I'm sorry.
You can briefly.
I'm sorry. I'm over my time
now, but you'll have an opportunity during your rebuttal time.
I will. Thank you. I will hold off until then. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, I'm Major Michael Burnett, along with Colonel James Rome. We represent the appellee, Airman Basic, Brandon Rhodes. I heard rumors before, but they were put to an end by my counsel.
How do you deal with the prejudice issue that's been raised? The military judge didn't perfunctorily ask him if he had any questions or was satisfied with his counsel. For 2 pages, he went through that with him. He even asked him whether he had any questions about the advice he'd been given, to paraphrase, in what's your response, if you get to prong two.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not surprising he answered that way to the military judge, because he said, I heard rumors before, but they were put to an end by my counsel. Of course he thought he was satisfied with his counsel, because he believed he didn't have to register as a sex offender. He got the advice from his counsel. And in that case, it's not unexpected that he wouldn't have jumped up and said, no, Your Honor, I'm not happy with my
counsel. Is an affirmative misrepresentation per se IAC?
No, Your Honor. It's not per se. It's just a fact to consider under the totality of the circumstances. But there's no question that at the Dubé hearing, he testified that he did not believe that he would have to register, and that the rumors that he heard before were put to an end by his counsel, and the military judge specifically found him credible.
You don't disagree that in the Dubé hearing that he acknowledged that the counsel never told him he didn't have to register. That was the impression that he had, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
With respect to prong two, how do you deal with the questions that I asked the government about, which is the fact that he'd never raised this once he did find out until the appeal? I mean, he didn't raise it in clemency. He didn't go back to his attorneys. He didn't raise it at all until this appeal.
In part, Your Honor, I think the question goes to his credibility. Do we believe him when he says he thought it was important? Because Your Honor's question is, well, if he thought it was important, he would have raised it in clemency. That goes back to credibility, and now we're back to the military judge's credibility determinations, which this court necessarily defers to. But additionally, the fact that he didn't raise it in clemency, he said he was angry at his lawyers. He may not have known that he could raise it in clemency. He's not a lawyer.
He didn't do it in... So he didn't raise it out of spite against his lawyer? That's kind of cutting off your nose to spite your own face.
Clients have done worse things, Your Honor. The fact that he was upset with his attorney is not an unreasonable explanation for as to why he didn't raise it in clemency, as is the fact that he may not have known that he was entitled to any relief. Again, this issue was originally raised and posed upon.
Wait a minute. He doesn't know he's entitled to relief. Are you suggesting his military counsel was incompetent, ineffective?
He was clearly deficient. The ADC. Here we have an ADC.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
We're talking the second military, the guy who did the trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right. You're suggesting he was ineffective in the clemency?
No, Your Honor. We don't know what the conversations were between Captain Logan, the Area Defense Counsel and the appellee for clemency, but I'm not suggesting that he was ineffective for...
I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with the record as I should be. Did the accused in this case fire the ADC once he found out that he had to file as a sex offender?
No, Your Honor, but again, he was getting the advice from the civilian, so...
Well, who handled his clemency?
The ADC. But again, this all goes back...
When did he fire his civilian defense counsel, or did he?
The record's not clear whether he ever fired him, and certainly...
Well, if he's that mad at him, did he have an ongoing attorney-client relationship with somebody he was very angry at and continued to pay him? What went on here?
The record's not clear as to when he was fired, if he was fired. But certainly a client could be tipped off at that lawyer without going to the formality of trying to fire them while he's in confinement for 20 months. I'm sure he had other things on his mind as well.
The CCA seemed to suggest that all the parties understood that he hadn't had an emphatic answer to his question, but relied instead on this concept that he was left with that impression. Do you think that's an accurate statement of the record as you see it?
It's accurate to say that he testified that he had an impression at one point in the record of trial. He also said he heard rumors before and they were put to an end by my counsel, and I believed I would not have
to register. That's in the Dubé.
That's in the Dubé record of trial. The military judge specifically found him credible.
So is it fair to say that when the judge is going through the colloquy with him about, do you understand the terms of the agreement, do you have any questions, and so on,
perfectly satisfied.
That appellant knows that he's operating on an impression?
He believed he was operating under the belief that he would not have to register. That was his testimony, along with the impression testimony as well. But when we look at the totality of the circuit, again, we can't just look to
but
what he said.
But he is aware
impression.
At the time that he has not received an emphatic answer.
He was aware at the time that he had not received a literal, direct or no answer, just like in Quan. Just like in Quan, which this court has cited, the majority in Dineo cited as an affirmative misrepresentation case. In Quan, there wasn't a yes or no answer. All counsel said was, it's technically a possibility, but it's not a serious possibility. We could say, oh, well, the client had an impression there. But still, the court said, under the totality of the circumstances, that's an affirmative misrepresentation.
But in Quan, did the counsel ever say, I don't know?
No.
Was he asked multiple times suggesting that he hadn't received a satisfactory answer?
No, but in fact, in this case, counsel, the question, I believe, was asked more times than it was asked in Quan. But no, Your Honor, I don't believe in Quan there was a response that I don't know. But again, that's not all he said. If all he said was, I don't know, that would be one thing. But when you say, I don't know at one point, and then on the other occasions when the civilian counsel says, I don't see why you'd have to, based on these offenses, holding himself out as having somehow conducted research, or that he has some sort of...
Did he hold himself out as having somehow conducted research, or did he simply say, I don't know, I don't think so?
A client listening to that attorney say, I don't see why you'd have to, based on these offenses. These seem minor. It's just females playing around, is how he referred to it, just foolery. A client could certainly construe that as, oh, well, he must know what he's talking about. I mean, after all, this is his lead civilian defense counsel. The court-martial took place in Illinois. The counsel's license in Illinois. Appellee is concerned about Illinois. And at the time, in 2004, the Illinois courts say, oh, by the way, if you're in the military and you're convicted of indecent assault, yes, you have to register. and Mr. Connor, the civilian counsel certainly didn't know that.
Counsel, it's kind of hard to get the sequence here of what was happening during this time period. Rose testified as to what Connors told him. He said that Connor said, I don't see no reason why you'd have to register. My best advice is to go ahead and sign the PTA. Is there any place in the record that indicates that Connors' other representations that he didn't know came before or after that, or is it just unclear?
It's hard to tell, Your Honor. There is a portion of the record where Appellee says, in the end, I said, what's the best advice you can give me? And Connor said, I don't see why I'd have to. My advice is to sign the PTA. I construe that as the time that he was advised, but the direct and cross didn't really specifically get into a chronological timeline.
In terms of timelines, what does the record establish as to the precise date on which the appellant learned that he would have to register as a sex offender?
I don't have the precise date, Your Honor. However, the record does say that he learned on it. He learned this when he walked into confinement.
Which was on what day?
I do not have that answer, Your Honor. I know the trial was, I believe, 11 October 2005, so I assume it would have been sometime around there.
Sometime after that. And what does the record establish as to the date on which he wrote his clemency request?
That
my copy of the joint appendix doesn't have a date on that letter.
All right, then mine will not as well. But
so
it certainly was after.
We have a 3 November submission from his defense counsel. His defense counsel put together the packet with all the letters in it. Does the record establish that appellant wrote the clemency letter before or after he learned of the sex registration requirement?
I don't believe it's clear, Your Honor.
Did the debate judge make any findings of fact on that?
No, Your Honor.
Did the government ask the debate judge to make any findings of fact on
no,
that?
No, Your Honor.
So do we know, as a matter of fact, what came first, what came second?
We don't, Your Honor.
Thank you.
But additionally, I want to emphasize that with respect to the clemency, it is really trying to poke holes in his credibility. And that's fine. The government can do that. But when a military judge makes a specific finding of credibility, this court necessarily defers to it. And so then the question is there evidence in the record to support that credibility determination? Yes, there is. Because
did the parties have an opportunity to make credibility arguments to the judge at the debate here?
Did
any party rely on the clemency submission in making those clemency or in the credibility arguments?
No, Your Honor. But, yes, credibility certainly was an issue. As a matter of fact, the defense counsel objected, and the military judge overruled the objection and said, certainly we'll hear cross-examination from the government counsel on whether Amory Rose is credible. And additionally, the fact that the air defense counsel testified that the one thing from the case that stands out, the one thing that was clear to me, is that he was not going to plead guilty if he had to register as a sex offender, certainly suggests that he wouldn't have agreed to plead guilty if he thought he had to register as a sex offender. The government's own witness is, in fact, one of our best witnesses in that regard, to show that he must have believed that he did not have to register.
Did the debate hearing address the question of whether, but for this alleged misrepresentation, he wouldn't have pled guilty? Was that one of the questions that they were looking at?
The military judge thought that, the debate judge thought that her charter was limited. She didn't specifically make a finding of prejudice, but she did say that the appellee said that he would not have pled guilty had he known that he had to register. That was certainly part of his testimony, and the military judge again found him credible. So I would say yes. Although she didn't make a specific finding that, yes, there is prejudice in this case, but even if she did, that's reviewed under a de novo standard.
So are you deriving that from the statement the court finds that sex offender registration was a key concern for Rose?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have an opinion as to the implications of the Padilla case for this case?
The implications of the Donato case for this
case?
No,
Padilla. Padilla?
Padilla.
Padilla?
I do not, Your Honor. I do not.
Could you return to my question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And tell me what in the judge's findings of fact or conclusions is your strongest evidence that you would have us look at for the argument that he would not have pled guilty?
I have to say, Your Honor, she did not specifically say her findings of fact. However, she said the court does not believe Aaron Rose testified falsely at the hearing regarding his pretrial interactions. Like all the witnesses, he believes he testified truthfully, and he did testify at the debate hearing. That was part of his testimony, that he believed he would not plead guilty. That he would not have pled guilty had he known he had registered.
So that's what you think is your best argument for establishing that?
For that particular point.
Yes,
establishing,
no, right.
Yes, Your Honor. For establishing prejudice, I think one of our very good arguments is the fact that, by the way, civilian counsel testified that if he had to do it all over again, he would have advised Aaron Rose to change his plea. The civilian counsel said, had I known about this, I would advise him to plead not guilty. And if the civilian counsel can't say that, then certainly why can't Aaron Rose?
How do you respond to the government's slippery slope argument that defendants are given impressions about a lot of things, about guilty pleas? And later on, they're going to say, wait a minute, I wasn't under that impression. I mean, where do you draw the line, and does this case open the door?
No more than Kwan opened the door, Your Honor.
Kwan's not our case.
No, Your Honor, but this case has cited Kwan as an affirmative misrepresentation case in Donato. And Kwan didn't open the door to all these frivolous lawsuits. It's just you look to the particular facts and circumstances of every case under totality of the circumstances. And the focus is not just on impressions. That's inaccurate. And the Air Force Courts was careful to note that we're not saying this is all about his impression. We're looking to the totality of civilian counsel's advice, and that's what this court should do as well.
And you think that's the strongest argument for why there was ineffective assistance on prong one?
On prong one, Your Honor? Yes. The totality of his responses and the fact that the Area Defense Counsel testified that there is no way Appellee was going to plead guilty if he had to register as a sex offender, certainly shows that he wouldn't have pled guilty.
Let me restate that. Do you think the strongest argument is misimpression?
Effectively mislead is how we refer to it.
Okay. The choices being none of the above, misimpression, failure to investigate, erroneous advice. There's a number of different ways you can look at the first prong, and I'm trying to ascertain, because this comes in the context of a certified issue where it's framed a particular way, but if you were framing it, how would you frame the first prong of Strickland?
I'd say it would be a combination of failure to investigate a question that a client identifies as a significant issue in deciding how to plead, along with overall effectively misleading someone based on a totality of the circumstances. But certainly, when a counsel hears from a client who says, no, I don't want to plead guilty to this, if I have to register a sex offender, you have to do more than simply say, well, whatever. I mean, counsel has an obligation in that situation to at least conduct some research. I mean, that's what we do as lawyers. We conduct legal research. It's not that much of a burden to find that civilian counsel should have done that in this case when the client specifically identified the issue and identified it as a significant matter in deciding whether to plead. So I think it's a combination of the advice that was given, effectively misleading like in Kwan, and failing to investigate. I mean, there's clearly a lack of communication in this case. Defense counsel said that Airman Rose's case got squeezed in at the last minute between three other cases, and that his preparation and ability to assist with the case was limited. He said he would have gotten more information as to how the PTA discussions occurred, because he was surprised when he found out that Aaron Rose was pleading guilty. I mean, here we have civilian counsel testifying that he didn't give the issue of sex offender registration credible concern. He gave it diminished importance. And you have the area defense counsel saying, oh, it seemed like the key issue. I mean, we should look at the totality of the circumstances. Aaron Rose did not get the representation that he should have under the Sixth Amendment. a crucial service that criminal defense lawyers perform for their clients is, in fact, advising them on whether to plead guilty and under what terms, because an accused gives up significant rights by pleading guilty, because the plea is untested in the crucible of the adversarial process. And certainly this court should scrutinize the totality of the representation that was given or not given to appellee. And of course, the test for prejudice is not an onerous one. The test is not the focus of an outcome of a potential trial, but whether there's a reasonable probability that but for the error, he would have changed his plea. And like I said earlier, when you have civilian counsel saying, I would have changed my advice as to the plea, that is clearly meeting the second prong of Strickland. Turning, if there are no further questions on that, turning briefly to the issue, the second certified issue on the affidavit. In their brief, the government specifically refers to the government's right to defend against ineffective assistance of counsel claims by gathering evidence to refute appellee's attacks. However, the government's desire to seek affidavits to support their claim ends where 502 begins. Cameron Rose didn't make a claim against Captain George.
I have a question. Who has a burden to who is the burden on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
We do, Your Honor.
Would your case be stronger or weaker if that captain's affidavit said, I explained everything and informed him that, in fact, he would need to register as a sex offender?
It would have no effect, Your Honor, because all it would show is that Appellee can rely on his civilian lead counsel's advice, the one he's paying for advice, and 2 months later he's still asking the questions. He's asking the questions of his new defense attorney, his new area defense counsel, and of course it's reasonable to believe that an individual is going to continue to ask the questions of their new detailed defense team. So even if he submitted an affidavit saying, oh, I told him that he did have to register, that would have no impact on the outcome of the case.
Why wouldn't that be within the responsibility of the debate judge to decide how much weight to give to that particular aspect of the information on the totality of the circumstances? Isn't that what a debate hearing is about? And why wouldn't it be proper for a judge, if he heard a defense counsel testify, he asked me that question and I cited him chapter and verse as to where he would have to register. Why wouldn't that bear on the totality of the circumstances?
I'm not saying that it would be irrelevant for a judge to hear.
Why isn't that an error then to deny the government the opportunity to present the testimony of the first defense counsel?
Privilege, Your Honor. 502.
Doesn't the assertion of IAC waive privilege? Or can you cabin it off?
What's the combined performance of counsel?
Yeah. Of detailed defense counsel. Correct. I mean, certainly we're going to look to
the performance of your counsel, and he was one of his counsel. He can't pick and choose and say, oh, I want this one because he's the ineffective one, but I don't want the other one.
Let's get an affidavit from the Dubai Area Defense Counsel, who also represented him, and from me. I mean, to open it up to any counsel.
Well, are you suggesting there's some reason why we need to look at
No, Your Honor. But if I assume that my time has concluded, may I briefly conclude?
I think it might be time, yeah.
To open the door to allow the government this late into the proceedings to suddenly request affidavits from anyone and everyone, in fact, opens the floodgates.
This late being today or in the course of the Dubai hearing?
They had, at the Dubai hearing, the judge asked the prosecutor any issues with this privilege argument. Prosecutor, no. Government never asked for an affidavit. Up until shortly after oral argument, the Air Force.
Well, that's a waiver argument, not a privilege argument.
And it is, Your Honor. It is. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have a rebuttal?
I want to address real quickly this idea that appellee was all so very credible. In the military judges at the Dubai's finding of fact, she found that all of the witnesses were credible. She said that in observing their demeanor, their overall testimony, that all of the witnesses appeared to the court to be testifying truthfully and credibly to the best of their recollection.
She also said that Mr. Connors had the most difficulty in trying to remember the details.
True.
And shouldn't we factor that in at all, or should we ignore that?
No, we don't have to ignore it. This is all part of the totality of the circumstances. But she's talking about all the witnesses. That includes Mr. Connors as well.
What do you do about the point that Judge Baker raised, which is, you know, whether it was a misrepresentation or not, I don't think anyone disagrees that Mr. Connor did not look into something that the client asked him to look into.
Mm-hmm. Well,
how do you deal with that on prong one?
I'm sorry.
How do you deal with that fact with respect to prong one of a Strickland analysis?
Right. Not answering the question that the...
That your client has repeatedly asked you and said is important to them.
Right. That is one consideration in the many considerations of whether he received a fair trial and had ineffective assistance of counsel. In this case, that should not be the controlling consideration because even under Miller, there is no requirement to answer all questions regarding collateral consequences. It is just one thing to consider.
Everybody wants totality of the circumstances here. You're just picking different circumstances.
And that's true. And they're all in there.
You know the test, don't we?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, your time is up. I will give you an opportunity to conclude briefly, but I also want to give you an opportunity, if you wanted to address the question I asked defense counsel, and that is, number one, does the record establish the precise date on which the accused wrote his clemency letter, and two, does the record establish whether the government at the debate hearing relied on the clemency materials for purposes of addressing the credibility of the appellant in this case?
The record is not clear about the precise date. We would make our estimations much as you did, Your Honor, based on the date of trial and that he would have gone into confinement absent some sort of deferment the day of trial. And then the defense counsel submitted the clemency letters. His was dated that November 3rd date, so it makes sense that it was probably in November.
We don't know. But also, did the government rely on the clemency materials at the debate hearing with respect to the issue of credibility of the assertions made by the appellant?
I would not say that the government relied on the clemency for credibility. They actually brought up the fact that appellee was just a liar, that he lied in his declaration, that he lied at the Walmart when he was going through and representing that he was...
Counsel, I think the court, unless there's some other impression, the court's aware of all the other arguments that were made at this debate hearing. This was the simple question on the credibility issue related to the clemency proceedings, whether that was raised at the debate hearing. And your answer to that is no.
The answer is no.
Thank you. You may briefly conclude.
Just briefly, Your Honor, I would emphasize again that the burden is on the appellee in this case. I would emphasize that the slippery slope lowers the bar for IAC claims, and that is essential to consider. And that if the ADC was so surprised, he certainly had an opportunity to put that in his clemency letter, and he did not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 10:20.